journalism is more important than ever.
Okay, we just listened to Yellow Ocean by Chita and Chang Seung-wan. I hope you guys all like the songs that I played out for you today. I'll be back next Thursday, as always, at 1 p.m. with a new K-pop Cafe episode. I'll leave you with Someday by Michael Bublé. Thank you so much for listening to my show, everyone. Have a great day. 좋은 하루 되세요.
I love seeing you happy. I miss seeing that smile. It's been such a long time. And although I don't have you, I know now that I need to somehow make you mine. And I won't lie, touching you with him.
Guys, you are listening to All Access Pass here on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Desi Nair. I'm your host for today, and I am the Access Collective Coordinator. So here on All Access Pass, we have a new show time, so you might have not heard of us before. We cover issues and topics concerning accessibility for those living with disabilities, both on and off UBC campus. Now, our show is put together by an amazing group of volunteers that I get the privilege to work with every week. And our collective is always looking for new people. If you are interested or want to suggest a topic for us to discuss about accessibility, you can go ahead and send us an email. Our email is accessibilitycollective@citr.ca. As always, we are broadcasting live from the AMS Student Nest on the traditional, ancestral, occupied, and unceded territories of the Musqueam people. Now, today on our show, we're going to have throw a couple things at you today. But mainly, on Tuesday, I sat down with UBC Professor Barnes, who does fieldwork in economic geography, and I will be playing my interview with him in this hour. Before that, I'd like to introduce you guys to some of our newest collective members here in the Access Collective. Now, we're always looking for new members, and come January, we met some January and October, actually, we met some really awesome new people who have joined our collective and helped put together the show. So without further ado, I want to introduce you guys to Wen, Olga, and Lauren.
Hello, my name is Wen, and I'm a third-year student in food science program. I'm feeling really excited because it is my first time in the studio. I've just joined the collective this week. Out of no reasons, I've always been extremely fancy of the radio, the microphone, and the studio since an early age. I am always reading out loud the essays and poems and record them once and once again, presuming I am a reporter. In this winter break, I saw posters in the laundry room and I emailed Desi, so that is how I became involved. One interesting thing about me is that I like to imitate people talking and acting, sometimes so exaggeratedly that people get mad at me.
Awesome. Hi, my name is Olga, and I'm a third-year cognitive systems student in the Brain and Cognition stream. And I've been listening to Desi hype up the Accessibility Collective for months, so this term I finally decided to join. I'm excited to work with radio as I've never done it before. So it'll be interesting to learn about all the aspects that go into making a good show. So far, I think I'm most interested in the research aspect of production. And a little bit about me, I love reading, especially fantasy, and I enjoy anything computer-related, be it programming or video games.
Hi, I'm Lauren and I'm a second year in arts hoping to do film production. I love watching movies and probably spend too much time doing so. I became interested in All Access Pass because of having ADD myself and being previously interested in invisible disabilities. I'm also interested in radio production in general and think it's a great way to get involved at UBC. Last semester, I helped out with a few interviews for the show and led the research and creation of our piece on the stigma behind ADHD and ADD. I hope to get more involved this semester and keep working with All Access Pass.
Hey there. So those were just some of the members on our collective. Now, our collective is very open. We take people of all experience with radio. As long as you've got an interest for accessibility and want to help us out, we are welcome to you. So definitely send us an email if you're interested. So with that, we're going to head into a little bit of a music break. What I'm going to play here right now is a song by No Name. This is Sunny Duet featuring The Mind. Now, No Name, she gained wider recognition and acclaim following her appearance on the track Loss for Chance the Rapper's very well-known mixtape Acid Rap. So I'm just going to go ahead and play that. Hope you guys enjoy.
Name's just a name. Don't call me crazy. It rain, don't feel like rain. It's been so common lately. Love is just a word. Unless you show it. So tell me what you call me when I'm gone. Not around.
Have a name and look like butterflies and Hennessy. I'll trade it in for happiness, but joyful don't remember me. Sitting on my front lawn, waiting for him to call me. He said he knew my name. Shame on me, fool me once, shame on you. I got my candy cane, my name is hella pimpin' too. You could watch a play a move. Or we could call this ice cream in my Sunday sweater. Patent leather tethered to a fancy car. I know you wanna touch me in your old religion caviar. Holy water avatar, blue like the tears when I left you. I met you on Saturday morning, it's raining and storming. Approach me with caution, I come with a warning.
Sweep me
off my feet. I probably clean my act up. I swear I'll be on my best behavior from this day forward, a lifetime after. If you're my baby, and I know this world is something crazy, that don't mean nothing. Hate me, call me crazy, as long as you know my name.
I used to dream in parables, partially love you naturally, happily ever after. Cigarettes over blunts, now Miracle Whip at Funtown. Summertime, delight, delight, Mississippi over ice, Janet Jackson and flashing lights. We could dance a little if you like to. My vagabond's a lonely road, a celebrated haiku. Contemporary, overzealous, think I really like you. Sing with me, paranoia, light blue. Piano was a deep red, your fingers were a green hue. Watch you make a rainbow out of sacrificial love in the club off the alley, alley, feeling holy. The DJ was religion, I swear on the Pope, he know me.
Name is just a year. Don't call me crazy. And rain don't feel like rain. It's been so common lately. And love is just a word. Unless you show it. So tell me what you call me when I'm cold, not around.
Are you interested in Indigenous issues?
Are you down with decolonization?
Do you have something to say?
Or have a topic to share?
We have just the thing.
Join UBC's first ever Indigenous Radio Collective.
We're a team of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
I'm Niska from my mother.
From the Tahltan Territory.
I'm a settler from Washington State.
I'm from the Qualicum and Musqueam First Nations.
I am Quechua Indigenous from Saraguro, Ecuador.
We broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land
of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Whatever you want to talk about, we're into it.
Everyone is welcome, no experience necessary.
Unceded Airwaves airs every Wednesday from 1 to 2 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
And we meet every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. to plan our upcoming shows.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Unceded Airwaves.
We want to hear your story.
So, hey everyone, you are listening to All Access Pass. I'm Desi Nair. I'm the collective coordinator for the show, for the Access Collective. I'm joined here today with Professor Barnes from UBC. He is a professor in economic geography and was appointed at UBC in 1983. Nice. He was made fellow at the Royal Society of Canada. He was awarded the Ellen Churchill Simple Award from the University of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2014, he was elected corresponding fellow of the British Academy. And if I'm not mistaken, right now you're working on studying German geographers during the Nazi period, as well as creative industries in Vancouver and Seattle.
Yes, that's all correct.
Yes, and did I leave anything out? Is there anything else you want
to
know?
No, there's nothing more to my life than what you just said.
We did our research. Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. So thank you for coming in. So the first question we had when we were doing our research, we read that you'd kind of take a economics and history and you look at it from a geographical perspective. Like, what got you interested in that specific field? Like, what was there, like, a specific thing that got you started?
Yes, I suppose so. I did my schooling in Britain. And they have something that's called A-levels at between 16 and 18, and they're the exam you take, in effect, to get into university. And so I did geography and economics. You usually only do, at least when I was going through, it's changed a bit since then. You typically only did two or three subjects, and I did geography, economics, and chemistry. Hated chemistry. Failed chemistry, in fact. But I loved geography and economics. And so I ended up doing a degree at University College London, in geography and economics.
So did you see that kind of like, was it in high school or was it in university where you were like, oh, these correlate together?
Yeah, I mean, I did a number of economics courses, and I was always interested in economics. I really think the economy is absolutely pivotal. It just determines so much about social life. So I was always interested in the economy, but I didn't like the way that economists typically dealt with the economy.
Like in what ways would you say?
Well, it tended to be quite abstract.
Right.
A series of these idealized assumptions which never seemed to actually play out in the real world. Whereas geography, in contrast, was all about the real world.
Right, right.
And it seemed like a perfect marriage.
Awesome, awesome. I was reading, I think it was it for the Israel Times, if I'm not mistaken? There was an article you contributed to about, like, the, is it spatial theory?
Yes, this goes back to this work that you mentioned at the outset, which is my interest in German geographers.
Right.
And one in particular, a man called Walter Kristaller, designed a theory of urban settlement. When the Nazis began to occupy parts of Eastern Europe, beginning with Czechoslovakia and Poland, they recreated on the ground this theory of settlement that Kristaller had come up with. It was horrendous in all kinds of ways because it was also twinned with the racist politics of Nazism.
Right.
So all the existing residents, or at least anyone who was Jewish or even Slav, they were forced out of their land.
Right.
And then only a relatively few number remained. And the Germans then brought in Aryans from the rest of Europe to repopulate these newly built towns and cities based on Kristaller's larger theory. It's called central place theory.
So there was really like a deep and thorough application of this ideology.
Yes.
That went on to affect a lot of people. And I guess I'm guessing because it was an actual like city and spatial structure that they were creating, I'm guessing it still has effects today, like in those towns.
Sure. And it's been picked up elsewhere, not with the same horrendous consequences. But in Europe, in both the Netherlands and France, has adopted this form of planning cities and their relationship, which is at the basis of Kristaller's theory. I was interested in this because I'm interested in how knowledge gets constructed and shaped by the circumstances in which it occurs, including geographic circumstances.
Right, right.
So I was interested in how Kristaller's theory came to reflect that larger society in which it was produced and then deployed literally on the ground.
Yeah, that's really interesting to learn about. I think also because like you were saying with economics and because like how we learn in high school here in BC, which is where I grew up, and taking a lot of first year classes, we learn about Nazi occupation, but from a very like kind of like standard and almost like upper like political.
Right.
Perspective. So I think that's very important that we that you are looking at that for sure.
Yes. I mean, one of the other another person that I looked at, it was actually a father and son team. And the father actually gave instruction to Hitler during the 1920s while Hitler was in prison.
So connected.
I know.
Very connected.
And gave him this idea of something called Lebensraum, which means just living space.
Right.
And it was the idea that the German people required a larger space than they had been allotted, and that there was a justification for moving out. And, of course, that's exactly what Hitler did. And Hitler, at the same time that he was being given these lectures by Haushofer, his name was, Karl Haushofer, the senior, he was writing Mein Kampf.
Right.
And the lectures actually appear in the Mein Kampf.
Right,
making use of this notion of Lebensraum. And so House Hofer, when Hitler comes into power, is sort of elevated, given all these fancy positions. But House Hofer's son, who was also a geographer, he turns against Hitler, starts working with Hitler, but then he joins the resistance.
Right.
And in the end, he's involved in a plot to actually kill Hitler in 1944. Goes on the run, gets captured, but he's kept alive because he has all these contacts with the British. And particularly Himmler thinks that he might be able to use his contacts to get a good peace deal with the Germans. So he's kept alive until 2 days before the end of the war.
Right.
And then he's taken out and shot.
Hey guys, you are listening to an interview we did with Professor Trevor Barnes. You're going to listen to the rest of it after this break here. Right now we're going to head you into a song. This is Tycho. This is the song L from his album Awake. So enjoy.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Gay Games. And to the thousands of athletes, coaches, family, and spectators from around the world. Since 1982, the Gay Games have given lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender athletes and supporters around the world a chance to come together to compete, celebrate, and inspire others. It's been remarkable to see the Games thrive over the years.
The Gay Games is the world's largest sporting and cultural event specifically for LGBTQ+ athletes, artists, and musicians. In 1990, Vancouver held the third Gay Games, where approximately 7,300 athletes took part, and over 1,500 cultural participants attended.
Hey guys, you are listening to All Access Pass. Just now, before that, you were listening to Tycho's song L. Now, Tycho is an American ambient music project led by Scott Hansen. He's most well known for his album Drive. Now, this song, L, this album, which is titled Awake, was a part of a three-piece band. It was more of an ambient music project, like I said. It's composed of Zach Brown, who does the guitar and bass, and Rory O'Connor, who does the live drums. Now we're going to tune you back into that interview with Professor Barnes we did on Tuesday. Here we go.
It says here that you were the author of the book, The Capitalist Space Economy.
Right.
Can you tell us a bit more about the book? I know it's one of your more recent...
No, that's actually based on my PhD thesis.
And so you built on it in a sense, or...?
Initially. I mean, it goes back... It's kind of it's a long story, but I'll try and keep it short. It really came out of my interest in economics, and the economics that I was taught was abstract, but it was also highly mathematical. And I was quite good at mathematics, and I enjoyed the rigor and the sort of cleanliness of the conclusions. Right. That could be had from a mathematical sensibility.
Right.
And that really informed how I did my PhD. I ended up going to the University of Minnesota in America, and I worked with probably the best geographer, mathematician working in North America. And so he was very keen that I express my ideas in a mathematical form. Which is what I did in this in my thesis. There were just pages of equations, and sort of more symbols, Greek letters, than I had words in English. And so it was a theoretical, and only a theoretical. Volume. So there was. I never tried to test anything out against the real world. A theoretical volume which tried to bring space, geography, my subject, but in an abstract way, into a political economic view. Again, this goes to how economics is does. Devise. I mean, there's what's called an orthodox economics, which is often known as neoclassical economics, which is ideologically politically on the right. It's for the most part about finding reasons why the market works well.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this other version of economics, which is called political economy. Its roots go back to the 18th century, but its most famous exponent is Karl Marx.
Right.
And it's a very different version of what the economy is. And rather than looking for the successes of the economy and celebrating things like market and its rationality, it in fact sees problems, that the market is inherently unstable and produces crisis, and along with crisis is all kinds of forms of misery for most people. And so much of that political economy tradition had been expressed in words rather than
mathematics.
So what I tried to do was to bring a mathematical sensibility, but also at the same time try to think through where geography in different ways might fit within that,
right,
but also express it through mathematics.
And did you find that that was a good approach to bring in mathematics?
Yeah, I enjoyed doing it, but the more I thought about it after I'd done it, the more it seemed so distant from the world. And I really did want to be more engaged with the world, to be right. part of the world in a way that this book that I'd done clearly wasn't.
Right.
It was the thing, it was really what I most disliked about my economics courses. And I'm still not entirely sure right. why I did it, because what I'd always enjoyed about the geography part of my degree was a feeling of being in place, of dealing with the real world in its different geographic forms, whereas this thesis was just this abstract, distant
right.
Expression of the world.
It was kind of guiding your interest, yeah. but then also yeah. like trying to connect them all together.
And so my early career, when I arrived in 1983, I mean, I just finished my PhD thesis. And, that in order to stay at UBC, to remain a professor, you have to publish or perish.
Right, right.
So my early work was publishing this right. Very mathematical work. And the book came out of that.
Right.
But at the same time, I was also trying to run completely the other direction and do something quite different.
Right.
That was much more based in the real world. And in sort of real geography. And so I actually did work on the forest industry.
Right, right, yes.
So even though I was continuing to actually publish this work during this early period, in some ways it wasn't my interest. I had to do it to keep my job.
Right.
But what I really was much more passionate about was this work on forestry, as well as the more historical, which, again, always kind of roots you in place and, of course, time.
Right. So would you say that you took – that was kind of – there was a lot of takeaways from that, and then you – from there you were able to approach your work afterwards in a more clearer sense, I guess.
Yes, yes. I've become interested in context and bringing context to bear on whatever work that I was doing, which was completely absent in my earlier work. It was context-free. It was about these ideal individuals who could be defined mathematically in terms of certain assumptions around rationality. I kind of set them in motion in mathematical space, but had nothing to do with the hurly-burly of the everyday world, which is what I really wanted to get back to, and which I think context is all about.
Oh, awesome. So, as well, I saw. So, you said you worked with the forestry industry
yes.
in the past, and then you're currently working comparing the industries between Vancouver and
yeah.
Seattle. So it seems
yeah.
like you've picked a good spot to recenter your work
right.
and work out of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what happened? I mean, in some ways, I arrived just as the forestry industry in British Columbia was failing.
Right, right.
1983, it was beginning to change then. I mean, at that time, I mean, I don't think this was true, but it was said by the premier, this was Bill Bennett, who's social credit, that half of every British Columbia's dollar came from the forest industry.
Wow.
It was absolutely massive.
Right, right.
And the forest companies, corporations kind of ruled the roost for the economy. But then from the late 1980s, that all changed. And Vancouver in particular began to decouple, to sever itself from the resource economy.
Right, right.
And we get a very different economy, which is high-tech, or has become a high-tech economy.
Right. And do you find it interesting or unsettling or both to learn about these kind of like shifting economies, especially with Vancouver's very unstable growth in real
right.
estate? Is that more interesting or unsettling to like learn about and dive into?
I mean, I think it's all I mean, it's fascinating. I'm not sure, politically, I have my own views about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Right. I think we're all kind of looking very uneasily.
I mean, even Trump's election into the United States, I mean, it's going to be an amazingly interesting period. I mean, it may be utterly terrible and horrifying at the same time. But for a social scientist, it's fascinating what's going on.
Exactly. And was there a certain reason why you chose Seattle as the comparative city, or is it just because of proximity?
Partly. I mean, that was what initially drew us. I'm working with someone from the planning department, a man called Tom Hutton. And we had talked about Seattle, and we didn't really know much about it. We knew that there were sort of comparable size cities. Seattle's a bit larger than Vancouver, but it had gone through a similar kind of transition in the sense that it started as a forest town.
Right, okay.
And then it moved into high tech. But we didn't really know quite the extent of how much of a high tech economy it is. And it blows Vancouver out of the water.
Right.
There's
right.
absolutely no comparison in terms of the economies. Vancouver clearly has the real estate, although, you know, what's happening now. To that, but in terms of the high-tech economies, Seattle just is so much larger, and it has these gigantic corporations which really give the economy give it a structure which the Vancouver doesn't have. So you know, you've got Amazon there, and of course you've got Microsoft. Starbucks is also headquartered in Seattle, as well as other companies as well, and that gives the economy of Seattle just such force and robustness, which is not true in Vancouver.
Right.
Hey guys, you have tuned into All Access Pass on 101.9 CITR FM. You are just listening to an interview we did with Professor Trevor Barnes from UBC. We're going to head into a bit of a music break right now. When we come back, we're going to play the last of that interview. Just a little preview here. He's going to be talking about some of the accessibility concerns and interests that came across when he was doing his fieldwork, him being Professor Barnes from UBC. So with that, we're going to head into our music break. I'm going to be playing some two songs for you here by Swim Team. They're a Vancouver band, and this is from their album Out of the Flood. Super new, super good. We're going to head straight into that. The first song here is Out of the Flood, which is the same title as the album. So enjoy, guys. Yeah.
Become a CITR member and make some new friends.
Members get discounts downtown at Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium, the Cinematheque, the Fall Tatooine, Selectors Records, Community Thrift and Vintage, Vinyl Records, Sakura's, Classical Records, and Beat Street Records.
What would we do without our friends?
Are You Aware Radio, alternate Thursday 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
Hey guys, you were just listening to two songs off Swim Team's new album, Out of the Flood. The first one you heard was Out of the Flood, the song, and the second one was Morning. Now we're going to tune you back into the interview we did with Professor Barnes, the last part of it. Enjoy.
So going on to another note here, we noticed that you you do a lot of your own field work, if I'm not mistaken. So how has being in a wheelchair affected the traveling you've had to do in other you've had to do for your research in other countries?
Yeah, it varies. I have a specially equipped car, which. Has a sort of side opening door, which then a crane comes out with the wheelchair, and so it's very easy to transfer. So as long as the buildings that I'm going into are wheelchair accessible, it's never been a problem doing this research in Seattle. I mean, all the government buildings,
right,
and the corporations we've been to. I mean, it's all amazingly. In fact, the whole city, Seattle, I think, is even better equipped to deal with wheelchairs than Vancouver is. Hillier, that's the worst thing, but the buildings themselves and even things like parking for wheelchair accessibility is better than Vancouver.
Right. And did you have to go to Germany for your research?
I'd been to Germany. That also is an amazingly well-equipped country.
That's good.
Even better than the U.S. I think what happened is, of course, that so much of the city structure was demolished.
Right.
At the end of the Second World War. So they rebuilt again, but they rebuilt in a way that was accessible for wheelchair users.
Right. And when was around the time that they were rebuilding?
Well, from the 1950s onwards.
Right.
But, I mean, even so many of the streets, that you don't even need a curb drop, I mean, which is obviously important here in Vancouver. But because so many of the sidewalks are just sort of effortlessly sloped down to the street.
Right.
And so you don't need these special sites where you can get down or get up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Germany is great. It's one of the best countries I've been to for wheelchair accessibility.
And was it mainly, do you usually go to the city centers in Munich and Berlin? Or?
Yeah, I've been to Berlin a couple of times and everything. Yeah, I mean, all the public transportation is wheelchair accessible, the trains, the trolleys. I've been to Heidelberg. That's slightly harder. They have these things, the schlosses, these castles, or ruined schlosses at least, it's more difficult to negotiate, but still not impossible.
Okay.
Unlike other cities in North America,
right.
Toronto and Montreal are just can be horrible.
Right.
Restaurants just.
But is it also because, you were saying with the city, does it have to do with kind of when the city was built?
I think so. I mean, modern cities are much better.
Right.
Clearly they can be replanned and allowance made. I mean, London, I go to London pretty often, twice, three times a year even. And that's improved just massively over the last 30 years. Or I've really been in I started being in a wheelchair in 1998. That was the first time I had one. And I have multiple sclerosis, and it's gradually gotten worse. And so I've needed to be more and more in the wheelchair. And over that period, so what's that, 20-year period that I've been going to London, there have been terrific improvements in the infrastructure. Right. So not only in terms of public buildings, sidewalks. I mean, central London is just completely wheelchair accessible, at least on terms of sidewalks and streets. But they've also made all the buses wheelchair accessible.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. You can't, the so-called tube, the underground system,
right.
For the most part, that is not accessible.
Right.
Although
right.
They, even there, they're making making some changes.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there in September of last year, and the station I was next to, which was Earl's Court, had put in a elevator, and I was able to go to several places because of reconstructions at the stations.
And was that over time, or was it kind of like a bigger city project?
Yeah, I think it's over time.
Right.
But these buses, the buses changed maybe 10 years ago.
Right.
To become, all of the inner city, all the central city of London buses are wheelchair accessible.
Oh, wow.
And they're free.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, you just, you hail down the bus, and then there is a ramp that comes out of the center,
mm-hmm.
and then a space. I mean, the only problem are the people who put their prams and wheelchairs there, and there's not, sometimes like words are spoken, crosswords are spoken, as I try and get into these spaces where there's other vehicles already parked.
In terms of like Vancouver as a city, an accessible city, do you what are your thoughts on
it? It's quite good. But I mean, my bête noir is sidewalks where there is a curb drop at one end,
right?
But there's no curb drop by the other end.
Oh no!
So you go all the way up the sidewalk, and then you're stuck. And
right.
So you have to go all the way back again.
Right.
I live in Douglas Park neighborhood, and there are many of those. I mean, I now, through bitter experience, learnt where they are. Downtown is also not as good as it should be because there are incredibly steep curb drops at some intersections. And unless I get someone to actually help me push up, I could never manage, or I would fall backwards.
That's interesting that you say that. I don't know if you know, but Vancouver is actually known as one of the most accessible tourist destinations. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, restaurants are pretty good, and cafes and so on. I think I've only been to a couple of places where I was not able to get in because of steps, internal steps. And nearly all of them have wheelchair-accessible bathrooms. But I just don't quite understand about these curb drops. I'd like to have more wheelchair-accessible parking slots. There's a few dotted around the city, but they're very few.
Right. I've heard that is an issue here. That's even an issue in the surrounding building.
Right, right.
Yeah. Something that I think we need to put more work into.
Right.
We're getting there.
Right.
I guess also, so you've been teaching at UBC since you were appointed in 1983?
Yeah, since 1983.
And were you in a wheelchair then when you were appointed?
No, I wasn't diagnosed. I mean, that doesn't make any difference, but no. I was diagnosed with MS in 1993, but I'd had symptoms that went back to being a teenager. But this is the nature of multiple sclerosis, that the symptoms come and go. It was very difficult to diagnose. This was during a period where there was no MRI machine, which has become the way in which to diagnose the disease. You could do a spinal tap, but even that was not perfect. So So I had all these weird symptoms which would come and go, and eventually, excuse me, in 1993, for the first time I went to a neurologist who diagnosed me within 5 minutes.
Oh, wow. Have you found that your kind of the dynamics of teaching has changed since you were in a wheelchair?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I used to, of course, stand up to lecture.
Right.
And, you know, I felt that was part and parcel of commanding the room, of being a professor.
Right, right. I
sort of would get up and I'd just bellow, but I was fairly animated and I would walk around and wave my arms. And, of course, being in a wheelchair, you just can't do that any longer. So I am literally a talking head. So I try and get into the middle of the room and avoid any of the hardware tables and things that might block my view or block the view of students to me. Mm. And then I sally forth. I've a loud voice. I still kind of bellow. But obviously, I don't go anywhere.
Right, right.
So I don't know what the experience is for the students.
Right.
I mean, I say to them at the beginning of the class that my goal is by the end of the class, you don't realize I am in a wheelchair anymore.
Right. That's interesting. And do you get to assign specific classrooms because of that, or because I know not all the buildings here, especially the older ones.
Geography is quite good where I teach. There was one big lecture room, which I do teach in often, which had stairs going, but there was an elevator put in, and there's an elevator in the building, so all of the teaching rooms I think are accessible.
Right.
I did. This was about 2 years ago. I was at the Barber Center and giving an exam,
mm-hmm.
which I thought would be completely wheelchair accessible.
Right, quite new.
But the exam room was one where there was no way to get down to the front.
Oh, no.
Unless you went downstairs. Oh. And so I had to actually administer the exam from the back of the room.
Oh, no.
So.
It's not always easy. I know some of our buildings are quite old. I didn't know that the IKB library had some off rooms there.
Right. I mean, the one thing is that it would be good, and maybe there is such a map, but I've never got one, because some of the buildings you have to get into them in a strange way.
Right.
It's not intuitively obvious.
Right, right.
The main entrance doesn't work, and so you have to go through some back way.
Right,
but
right.
I would like a map which actually had...
Are there no, like, open resources?
There may
access?
Well be.
Right.
I've never actually hunted anything down, so I don't want to carp unnecessarily. But but sometimes finding the entrance to a building is difficult.
Right, right. I was reading some stuff about how... in terms of accommodating students, there's been a lot of resources and awareness that has been brought up, but now there's a need to also highlight accommodation for faculty as well. Do you find that here, or?
UBC has been extremely generous in all kinds of ways as a faculty member in a wheelchair. So I have my own... individual parking lot that is just outside the building, so I have no distance to get to the building. The elevator has been put in, doors have been widened. UBC bought me this scooter that I'm sitting on.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I have absolutely no complaints about how I've been treated.
Oh, that's great. That's mm-hmm. great to hear. So I think we're going to finish up here. But before we end, I just wanted to kind of ask what do you see in the future for you and your with teaching at UBC and with